From Public Radio International, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. 150 years ago this summer, the great People's Poem of the New World appeared, self-published, as if in answer to Ralph Waldo Emerson's complaint that America, the poem, was yet unsung. And then in Emerson's mail one day, in a plain brown wrapper from Walter Whitman Jr. with the title Leaves of Grass, there it was. The most extraordinary piece of wit and wisdom that America has yet contributed, Emerson said. And to this day, the great sunbeam of a celebratory democratic consciousness. Walt Whitman, an American, one of the roughs, a cosmos, as he introduced himself, sounding his barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world. He said, I am the poet of the body and I am the poet of the soul. Also, I am your voice. It was tied in you. In me it begins to talk. The American voice that has never stopped talking for us, through us, and to us. Walt Whitman is next on Open Source. First, the news. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source on radio and the internet, celebrating the sound of the human voice, the recitative of fish peddlers and fruit peddlers, the loud laugh of work people at their meals. Quoting Walt Whitman on the 150th anniversary of his Leaves of Grass, I celebrate myself, he began, and what I assume you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. Give us your Walt Whitman this hour, your favorite lines and lessons on the open source phone, 877-673-6767. Or log on and comment on our website, radioopensource.org. For a Labor Day weekend, we're listening specially for Whitman in the workplace, amid the anvil and tongs and hammer, the plumb bob and trowel and level. We ask the Chicago radio legend Studs Terkel to raise the curtain for us with the opening lines of Walt Whitman's Song for Occupations.
Come closer to me. Push close, my lovers. Take the best I possess. Yield closer and closer, and give me the best you possess. This is unfinished business with me. How is it with you? I was chilled with the cold types and cylinder and wet paper between us. I pass so poorly with paper and types. I must pass with the contact of bodies and souls. I do not thank you for liking me as I am and liking the touch of me. I know that it's good for you to do so. Neither a servant nor a master am I. I take no sooner a large price than a small price. I will have my own, whoever enjoys me. I will be even with you, and you shall be even with me.
That was Studs Terkel, and we'll have more of Studs before this hour is over. We're joined by two American poets who could both be said to come out of the great Whitman tree. Robert Pinsky in Boston was the U.S. Poet Laureate in the late 1990s, and John Hollander, the Sterling Professor of English at Yale. John Hollander, get us started. We're so glad to have you. Can you tell us who was this man, Walt Whitman, who kind of walked into immortality in 1855? Where'd he come from? Who was he?
Well, he was a Long Islander, and he was from a Quaker family, which is quite important, because when he talks about something like begging in A Song of Myself, it's something he would never do, viscerally. Also, the fact that he very strangely, as you will have noticed, doesn't use the traditional names of the months, but others as an end run around the pagan idolatry embedded in all of our names of the months.
I hadn't noticed that.
Yes.
But he seems to have been everywhere, done everything.
But yes, what's crucial, I think, about him is that he was a journalist. He was a newspaper man in the earlier part of the 19th century, when to be a journalist in America meant to be a person of literary culture. That hasn't been true for 50 years, although the ghosts of it did hang on through the first half of the last century. And he read a great deal, and he wrote a lot of prose and verse. A lot of it does not impress us very much now. It probably didn't impress him very much, because after a point in the later 1840s already, we see traces of this, he was beginning to write in a remarkable new way. He had developed a kind of free verse style. It's not that there was no free verse in English before that. As a matter of fact, the kind of style of early 20th century, early modernist free verse was written indeed by, of all people, Matthew Arnold in one poem, because he was trying to imitate, in a sense, what some of the German romantics had done with Greek poetry. But this was different. His long line and his way of stacking them together, his basic unit, which was the list or the catalog. And he was, I suppose, the greatest cataloger who ever lived.
The lists are fantastic. There are several points here we've got to touch on. First of all, do we just blow off his declaration that he's one of the roughs? Is this just pretense?
I would not say pretense. He is very clear himself about pretense and when he is not pretense. For example, the wonderful famous lines from Song of Myself, "Unscrew the locks from the doors. Unscrew the doors themselves from their jams," is both funny and brilliant in its critical revision of the tired metaphor from the biblical "open the gates, open up, open up." What a reinjection of life into the tired opening up, which is, of course, opening up is the bane of later 20th century psychobabble. But on the other hand, He writes as I ebbed with the ocean of life, before all my arrogant poems, the real me stands, yet untouched, untold, altogether unreached, withdrawn far, mocking me with mock congratulatory signs and bows, with peals of ironical laughter at every word I have written, pointing in silence to these songs and then to the sand beneath. And notice, sand beneath, not the ground beneath, indicate death, not the dust beneath, the biblical soil to which we will all return, but sand. The shore is always close to him in every way, and some of his most remarkable poetry are what Harold Bloom has called shore odes. Out of the cradle endlessly rocking, as I ebbed with the ocean of life. Remarkable poems, not part of Song of Myself at all.
John Hollander, you're remarkable. I want to open up the phone lines, 877-673-6767. But I want you to continue, John Hollander, on that line about lists. I started about the anvil and tongs and hammer, but then there's all of these things, the curry comb, the horsecloth, the halter and bridle and bits, the very wisps of straw. What is it about these lists? How does he get
away with it? There are so many. Well, the formal, I mean, lists are fascinating. By the way, I would recommend to every reader a brilliant little book called The List by a man named Robert Belknap, B-E-L-K-N-A-P, published by Yale University Press. It has a wonderful section on Whitman and listing, some of the best things I've ever read on that subject. But he's also interested in American literature generally. So he talks about Emerson, and he talks about Whitman, and he talks about Thoreau, and he talks about Melville, the way all of these writers use listing in totally different ways. A list can very often be what? A catalog, a laundry list, a shopping list, a litany. As we move toward a litany, we would want to say that each of the entries on the list starts maybe in the same way. That starting a line of verse in one way and then having the subsequent lines all start that same way is in classical literature called anaphora. It's the same beginning. And Whitman does a lot of that. He also varies it too. The part of Song for Occupations that we heard at the very beginning is just the opening. It goes on to be a remarkable catalog of
I wonder if you have a favorite.
People,
do you have a favorite?
People and Animals at Work.
Right. Is there a favorite fragment of the list that you'd want to read yourself? And then I want to introduce Robert Pinsky, who's probably got his own list.
Undoubtedly. I think everybody does, and everybody will respond to different things. But published in the same, in the 1855 Leaves of Grass, and if some of us talk about different editions, it's because the poem undergoes constant revision, addition, sometimes cutting back, sometimes adding at every level.
For the rest of his life, pretty much, right?
Yes, pretty much, yes. But I think the 1855 volume, the one which most people wouldn't recognize because none of the sections of it have titles. They're just untitled things. Later on, early on, he gives Song of Myself the title Walt Whitman, etc., and it begins to change. This section, number 15 in the later editions of Song of Myself, is like and unlike the Song of Occupations in certain ways, but I just love the beginning of it. It begins, "The pure contralto sings in the organ loft. The carpenter dresses his plank. The tongue of his foreplane whistles its wild ascending lisp. The married and unmarried children ride home to their Thanksgiving dinner. The pilot seizes the kingpin. He heaves down with a strong arm. The mate stands braced in the whaleboat, lance and harpoon are ready. The duck shooter walks by, silent and cautious stretches. The deacons are ordained with crossed hands at the altar. The spinning girl retreats and advances to the hum of the big wheel. The farmer stops by the bars as he walks on a first day, loafs and looks at the oats and rye."
John Holliday, we're going to have to take a break in a minute.
Yeah.
Take that apart a little bit. What are the words that leap out at a poet like you?
Well, the first pair of lines obviously have a musical relation to each other. There's a pure contralto singing and the carpenter making the noise, his plane whistling. Mm-hmm. Whistling its wild ascending lisp. That's almost a Homeric line, actually. But these together are equal partners on the same musical footing in this marvelous metaphoric exploration of what solo and concerted playing and singing in music are that he explores throughout his poetry.
John Hollander, hold it there. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about Walt Whitman on the 150th anniversary of his great poem, our great poem, Leaves of Grass. We'll be back after a short break.
Hi, this is Brendan. I'm the blogger-in-chief. Every show has a life on the blog before we put it on the radio. Next week, John Burns. He's been reporting for the New York Times from Iraq since the beginning of the war, and he will be talking to us for an hour. He knows Iraq and writes about it better than anyone we know. You have questions for John, of that much we're certain. Please share them at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The bemedaled American poet Stanley Kunitz turned 100 in July. This week, we had the privilege of recording Stanley Kunitz reading a fragment that he chose from Whitman's Song of Myself.
Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? I hasten to inform him or her it is just as lucky to die, and I know it. I pass death with the dying and birth with the new washed babe
and am not contained between my hat and boots, and peruse manifold objects, no two alike, and everyone good. The earth good, and the stars good, and their adjuncts all good. I am not an earth, nor an adjunct of an earth. I am the mate and companion of people, all just as immortal and fathomless as myself. They do not know how immortal, but I know.
That was the centenarian Stanley Kunitz reading from Leaves of Grass. Our boy guest in the studio, Robert Pinsky, former poet laureate of the United States, author of the famous Favorite Poems Project. Robert, give us some of your favorite Whitman.
I was thinking about Labor Day and about our country, and it can be said for Whitman, he really did like working people. He really did have an idea of so-called ordinary Americans that was full of affection and enthusiasm.
So do you, I should say, and you're famous for it,
too. He meant it. I think that Whitman, he didn't only invent Gary Cooper and Henry Fonda, he invented William Bendix, and he invented Eddie Bracken, too. People Stanley's age and mine will know who I'm talking about. He had a real relish, and it can make for what it is to be an American. And it's an idea so beautiful, so innocent, and so far from the newer idea of us as arrogant, reckless, heedless, that you could spend a lifetime thinking about the relationship between that beautiful innocence he asserts and what we have made of ourselves and what we've made of the world. I don't want to be anti-American about it. I think we still do have wonderful things about us. But listen to this capsule history he gives of this country from its beginning, what he calls the year one, right up to his own terrible cataclysm, not only of the war, the Civil War, in which he saw the wounded, tended to the wounded, Lincoln's assassination at the end of it. The vision of what it is to be an American working man or person. The haughty defiance of the year one, war, peace, the formation of the Constitution, the separate states, the simple elastic scheme, the immigrants, the Union always swarming with blatherers. I love that. The Union always swarming with blatherers and always sure and impregnable. The unsurveyed interior, log houses, clearings, wild animals, hunters, trappers, surrounding the multiform agriculture, mines, temperature, the gestation of new states, Congress convening every 12th month, the members duly coming up from the uttermost parts, surrounding the noble character of mechanics and farmers, especially the young men, responding their manners, speech, dress, friendships. The gait they have of persons who never knew how it felt to stand in the presence of superiors. The freshness and candor of their physiognomy, the copiousness and decision of their phrenology, the picturesque looseness of their carriage, their fierceness when wronged, the fluency of their speech, their delight in music, their curiosity, good temper and open-handedness, the whole composite make, the prevailing ardor and enterprise, the large amativeness, the perfect equality of the female with the male, the fluid movement of the population, the superior marine, free commerce, fisheries, whaling, gold digging, wharf-hemmed cities, railroad and steamboat lines, intersecting all points, factories, mercantile life, labor-saving machinery, the Northeast, Northwest, Southwest, Manhattan firemen, the Yankee swap, Southern plantation life, slavery, the murderous, treacherous conspiracy to raise it upon the ruins of all the rest, on and on to the grapple with it. Assassin, then your life or ours be the stake. and respite no more.
Mm. American History as a List from Walt Whitman, read by Robert Pinsky. Our phone is 877-673-6767. Robert, there's a list there again, obviously, but anything more you want to say about the craft?
Well, a thing he does with lists is the things aren't parallel. They aren't similar. And it's so full of idea, as John says, metaphorical, but you're almost lulled by, you almost don't notice that unsurveyed interior, okay, log houses, that's another place, clearings, yes, wild animals, hunters, trappers. Whoa, how did he do that? Unsurveyed interior, log houses, clearings, wild animals, hunters, trappers, surrounding the multiform agriculture, mines, temperature, the gestation of new states, Congress convening every 12th month. How are these things alike? You know, they are motion. It is not a list as a stack. It is a list as elements you put next to one another like chemicals to create an electrical current.
I put it to the listeners. This is the America of our dreams, of our past, of our grandparents, and our illusions, perhaps. But do we get it back, or do we kid ourselves reading Walt Whitman? Do you read him? When did you first read him? Does he make better sense to you today? 877-673-6767 is the open source phone on the 150th anniversary of Whitman's Leaves of Grass. John Hollander, do you want to comment on Robert's choice there?
The
question about, you know, Whitman's America today. Do we want to go there?
Oh. Well, there's still hope. I was fascinated by the earlier part of that catalog of that passage, which I had known and then forgotten the exact structure of. Because I was reminded of a playground in Jackson Heights, New York, in Queens, that I was with some of my grandchildren at a few weeks ago. And it was the most multi-ethnic milieu I've been in. And what struck me was the enormous civility of everybody there, from the smallest children up to young men who came and simply to sit around and talk and look at the fountains. It was amazing, and it did sound like what Whitman was talking about. Hmm. But mostly, of course, we don't see it. And remember that Whitman is always talking about America and its democracy as if it were a poem. He says America is the greatest poem there ever was. And one of the things about poems, if they're real poems, is that they're not literal. So there is something figurative and yet not crudely utopian or millenarian or anything like that about his America. But remember that as he says in Democratic Vistas, that remarkable book, democracy is a word the real gist of which still sleeps quite unawakened. And I think it's still true.
John, talk to me a little bit about the way he drops the substantive slavery. The whole passage I read is all noun phrases. It's all substantives. So that slavery is in some sense parallel to wild animals and free commerce and fisheries. And he drops it. He drops it into the catalog and adds another substantive, and then ends with that fragment, assassin, then your life or ours be the stake, and avoiding a verb.
Yes. Well, I think Whitman is often quite capable and delights in taking what we would think of as a more abstract noun, or particularly a noun designating some social construct. In the case of slavery, we might say an institution, and treating it as any other object for the imagination to consider and involve itself with. Mm-hmm. He's always insisting that he is doing that. I suppose that wonderful passage from, again, Song of Myself, I hear you whispering there, O stars of heaven, O suns, O grass of graves, and then the line, O perpetual transfers and promotions. Now, what he means by tropes, metaphors, literally, consider the Latin meaning of transfer and metaphor, same thing, and hyperboles for the promotions, I guess. And it is these, so that in the...
But he's talking about geophysics and the civil service at the same moment.
That's right.
Gentlemen, make way for another eminent poet. Rosanna Warren is on the line from Vermont. Her latest book of poems is called Departure. Rosanna Warren, welcome.
Thank you.
Do you have
glad to be here.
Do you have favorite Whitman?
I do have favorite Whitman, though it's hard to choose. But the passage I would want to read is the passage he came to number five in Song of Myself. So I want to remind us, as John did, that originally Song of Myself didn't have numbered passages, and so there was this extraordinary fluidity throughout it all. And so almost a shock to go to the later editions and find the numbers, which cramp it in a little bit, but make it easier to find.
Are you going to read about the grass itself?
I want to read not only about the grass, but about the great erotic encounter between what we might call the conscious ego and the soul, the source of creative ecstasy.
Hmm. Please.
All right. So I'll start reading and make a few commentaries along the way, if that's good.
Please do.
I believe in you, my soul. The other I am must not abase itself to you, and you must not be abased to the other. Loaf with me on the grass, loose the stop from your throat. Not words, not music or rhyme I want, not custom or lecture, not even the best. Only the lull I like, the hum of your velvet voice. I just stopped for a moment there to notice that when things are really getting hot in this poem, he always is loafing. So he loafs in the first section. Here's key section that's going to set the terms for all the transcendental vision to come. He's loafing again. And on the grass, where else would he loaf? And to remind us of John's contralto, we have this wonderful loose the stop from your throat and the velvet voice, the very physiological sense that Whitman, who loved opera and loved singing, had of how the human voice is produced, how very physically it's produced. Mm. And this notion of the stop, which is, of course, part of a musical instrument, but is also, I would think, the stop of what he felt to be oppressive, older, constricting cultures and political systems, which he's also loosing the stops from. Mm-hmm. And then he continues in the erotic visionary mode, where we sort of see lovemaking, but we also understand that it's going on inside the soul and releasing this great energy. I mind how once we lay such a transparent summer morning, how you settled your head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me and parted the shirt from my bosom bone and plunged your tongue to my bare-stripped heart and reached till you felt my beard and reached till you held my feet. Swiftly arose and spread around me the peace and knowledge that pass all the argument of the earth, and I know that the hand of God is the promise of my own, and I know that the spirit of God is the brother of my own, and that all the men ever born are also my brothers, and the women my sisters and lovers, and that a kelson of the creation is love, and limitless are leaves stiff or drooping in the fields, and brown ants in the little wells beneath them, and mossy scabs of the worm fence, heaped stones, elder, mullein, and pokeweed. And I would say that we cannot believe in the large promise of brotherhood and sisterhood in Whitman without believing in his pokeweed, without believing in his mossy scabs of the worm fence. It's completely grounded in that kind of observational truth.
Rosanna, that's so beautiful to hear in your voice. And I'm also noticing in my own edition how he's changed it over the years. The mossy scabs of the worm fence. Robert, do you want to gild that lily?
I was actually looking to John to tell me exactly what a worm fence is. Maybe Rosanna knows, too.
As a matter of fact, I do not. Yeah. I was going to ask Rosanna... I was going to ask Rosanna something else, though. This poem has something in it called the soul that is active, clearly, and it has something called the other I am, which is clearly passive. But I don't know, I've never been totally sure on each reading of this poem whether the other I am, it doesn't mean the body, but it means all of the rest of me, or is it the soul's other or some kind of antithetical being? You know, Whitman in Song of Myself distinguishes between my self, my soul, and then something he calls, and I quoted it before, the real me or the me myself.
Yes. Right.
These are three very different things
right.
in complicated relation to each other.
Do you want to undo the braid here, Rosanna?
Well, I won't say I'll do it conclusively, but because it's quite mysterious, but I would say that it seems to me that that the relationship of I and you is a marvelous model, that it is very, to use that word, fluid in the poem. And here, the I-you seems to be internalized to a relationship between a more conscious, potentially social self and the soul, but that the same kind of erotic energy then is transferred to an I and a you, where the I seems to be I as poet with a capital P, that Emersonian poet, and the you becomes the reader. And we are, too, clasped in a kind of erotic embrace by this poet who isn't personal anymore. It's not a personal I. So in section 42, when the I, the poet Vatic, Emersonian I, prophet I, says, I know perfectly well my own egotism and know my omnivorous words and cannot say any less and would fetch you, whoever you are, flush with myself. That fantastic fetching you, whoever you are, flush with myself. That word fetching, which he uses later in the poem, too, at the very end, the crescendo, failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged, missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere waiting for you. But I would just say that expanding from John's point a bit, that the I and the you conceived as poetic voice and the potentially to be born audience in this ecstatic union are also mysterious and yet full of promise. I mean, I think a promise that a reader feels any minute now still if you let the poem touch you.
Rosanna Warren, I want to say thank you so much for your reading and the way you read and the way you close read it and for joining us on Open Source. We're talking about Walt Whitman on the 150th of Leaves of Grass. This is Open Source from PRI.
What have you thought of yourself? What is it then that thought yourself less? Is it you that thought the president greater than you? Or the rich better off than you? Or the educated wiser than you? Because you are greasy or pimpled, or that you was once drunk, or a thief, or diseased, or rheumatic, or a prostitute, or are so now, or from frivolity or impotence, or that you are no scholar and never saw your name in print, do you give in that you are maybe less immortal? The sun and stars that float in the open air, the apple-shaped earth and we upon it, surely the drift of them is something grand.
That was Studs Terkel again. If there is a Walt Whitman in America in our times, Studs is it. We're going to hear from him again on the matter of Whitman's voice for America today. Robert Binsky and John Hollander, I'm fascinated by, I mean, Harold Bloom keeps saying that everything in the Western Hemisphere, even musical art, even jazz, even painting, derives from Whitman. I want to know, Robert Pinsky, how he forms you every day as a poet, how he teaches you.
He teaches me not to leave things out. So much of thought and art, so much of politics achieves what it achieves by looking past things or omitting things. And the idea of embrace or inclusiveness is not affected in the man. He really set out as an artist to put everything in. And the question, that artistic question, turns out to be a very important political, cultural question. America,
be quite particular.
Well, America holds itself together with a lot of things that are very ephemeral. We're proud of how we can improvise. Our greatest art that we invented, jazz, is based on improvisation. And not only in its structure, but even in the instrumentation, harmonies. The fluidity of the American feature film. Our success of our capitalism has got a lot to do with saying we'll make it work somehow, we'll invent something, we'll improvise. And it is an important question now for the whole world. The climate of the world may be changing. It's an important question whether a people and a country that can be great in these ways of making it up as you go along, improvising, fluidity, can also have a real culture, can have memory, which is one of the main components of culture. And he never wrote anything that was petty or trivial. He never wrote anything that was for only one audience or one occasion. I was in Camden this spring doing a poetry thing, and I stopped in at the tomb. And there on the threshold of the tomb, in one of these cheap, the clear plastic folders people put in their notebooks, some seemed like a teenager or somebody in their early 20s, some ambitious young boy had written a letter to Whitman, only slightly water-stained. And it was not the idea of Whitman. This person who wrote the letter clearly had been reading those lines, and he had sensed that this puts a lot in and it never deals with anything that isn't entirely important. Always thinks about how the ants and the worm fence and the wild animals,
whatever it means,
they're connected to slavery.
Interesting. John Hollander, do you want to take just a crack at how he informs you, your range, your words, your thinking, your politics?
Well, I share Robert's view in many ways. In a strange way, it is Whitman as much as any other poet who teaches me to avoid vulgarity. The difference between Whitman's sense of inclusiveness and vulgarity is this. He never makes a cheap shot. And vulgarity is making a cheap shot. It's Whitman who almost before anyone else is able to generate some notion of what we mean uniquely in America by class. And I don't mean a Marxian sense of social class, and I don't mean the terrible misinterpretation of the notion of social class, which now applies simply to income level. If there were any horrible lesson about what happened to social science and its inability to help shape serious thinking, it's that. But when we say someone has class, what we mean is a certain kind of elegance, no matter what the person is doing. This someone on her knees scrubbing vainly on a floor which will never get clean can have as much class as a coloratura soprano.
Right.
This is what Whitman begins to teach us. Vulgarity is what he always strives to avoid. There is one sad thing about this, is that an inability to read Whitman has produced more vulgarity in drivel and commentary about him and horrible, horrible wrong kinds of imitation than almost anybody.
Now, are you talking about the sexual question here or not?
No.
Okay.
His talking, the way he talks and writes about sexuality is immensely classy at that moment, I would think. No, I'm thinking of, well, this is related to his difficulty. As I may have said, Whitman's wonderful, wonderful work is nonetheless difficult in a way Dickinson's and Browning's are not.
Meaning?
It looks easy. It looks literal. and this is the trap into which most admirers fall. Both in and out of the game, watching and wondering at it, he says. This is in part the deepest kind of allegorist or visionary poet, saying, I'm in and out of growing 19th century realism in France and of America and eventually England, and even naturalism. I'm in it and out of it. Mm. And look, Rosanna talked wonderfully about his use of the word fetch. Despite his talking about the barbaric yawp, look at what he does with certain words. A word like drift or pass. Both of these are located somewhere between sing and sally forth, as he uses them throughout the big poem, or a densely complex term like vista. He means by that, one, what is seen, two, the point of place you see it from, three, the intervening veil or opacity past or through which you have to see the seeing. And thus, that marvelous book, Democratic Vistas, ultimately deals with the interplay of these meanings and the complexities of a democratic and of America itself.
I'm going to draw this simple moral for us amateurs. Just keep reading it. Keep reading it. Keep reading it. 877-673-6767 is our open source phone. John is calling from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi there, Chris.
Welcome, John.
Thank you. You know, I wrote a little essay on the internet about Whitman as the first blogger, and there was some discussion online.
Oh, that was you, yeah.
This was me, yes.
Good.
You know, we spoke earlier in the week about, or the show spoke about William Lloyd Garrison being a model for anybody wanting to do, journal activism. And when I looked at that early in the year, and I felt, well, there seem to be a lot of bloggers who didn't want to do journalism, who didn't want to report on things and felt they were just writing to be free and to celebrate themselves. And I was trying to find what role model might serve for all of them. And I came up with Walt Whitman. I'm not sure.
John, I think it's a good thought. I want to just add to it or trump it with an observation from a poet named Carl Dennis. And I stumbled on this, but it strikes me as very descriptive of what bloggers are doing, at least at the very initial stage of forming communities of outspoken Democrats. But Carl Dennis's line, one sentence encompassing it all, was this about Walt Whitman. He said, Whitman's ideal America is a country held together not by law or custom, but by a network of imaginative filaments thrown out by autonomous individuals who want to include as many people as they can in their own acts of self-definition. That's flattering us bloggers, but I think that's really what they're up to. And I think the internet is one of those very Emersonian and Whitmanian devices for extending this democratic conversation. End of speech. But I think that's what John had in mind. Does that make any sense, Robert? Or?
It leaves only one thing out. It does make a lot of sense. The only thing it leaves out is the same thing that I find left out of the web, to which I am as addicted in my own way as anyone, and that is the opera, the human body. And he was an artist, and
good
he did,
point.
As Rosanna pointed out, he did love opera. And for me, this has got to do with a lot of aspects of the web, including the bad manners on it. It's like people in their cars. If you were standing next to the same person in line at the grocery store, you say, oh, no, go ahead of me. But you're both encased in cars. You're kind of mean. And Whitman, I think that Carl Dennis is just a brilliant, funny, accurate vision of Whitman. And John, I keep up the good work. I don't mean to be hypercritical. But the one thing it does leave out is the physicality of poetry and of Whitman's poetry in particular, which is what makes it art. It's the difference between art and yak.
Yeah. Interesting. Robert. Performance, in other words. Oh. John Hollander.
Robert, do you think that Mr. Dennis was deliberately quoting from a noiseless patient spider, that wonderful poem of Whitman, which uses a trope of filaments
and
strung out, etc.?
I thought of that, too.
Yes. Whitman uses it in a much more interesting and complex way than that. But But, yeah.
It's one of the things that makes it so funny, because it is
certainly
all of us with our filaments, either of electronic filaments or filaments of thought or of the spider's guts.
Yeah, quite, yeah.
It's an amusing and affectionate version of the Whitman world.
You think we need an internet of the body and the soul?
I think we need art. I think we need art. Desperately and terribly, and it's not to say somebody may not find a way to do it in electronic means, but what I was thinking while listening to the thing about blogging, that the big difference is I can either literally or in my imagination run these things we're talking about through my voice, and I feel thrilled. It's like looking at a great building or watching a great movie or listening to great music.
Could I ask you both?
Robert,
go ahead, John.
No, I was just going to say that Robert said something very, very important, which has to do with a poem perhaps as being defined as something which you can read aloud to the benefit of whatever the poem is.
Yeah, it just feels
that
good.
That does not...
Yes.
Well, not just that it feels good for you to read it.
It feels...
But that,
the thing is
but that,
better. It's realized.
That's right. And that... a poem that someone, maybe even a sophisticated reader, can read several times, and then hear a good reader. And most people are not good readers, but there are good readers. And when to hear a good reader read it, suddenly all sorts of things are, as you say, realized.
John and I know that there are many famous professors who miss this.
Oh, well.
What is it?
Never mind.
Among you guys, but also among, the rest of us readers, what does it mean to be reading and celebrating this man today? Has he always been this easy, this fashionable, this accessible, or at least we thought?
As I understand it, he was very disappointed in his own lifetime. Not to be more popular, not to sell more, not to be known by more people. It was a profound frustration for him. And as I understand it, he was, if not exactly indigent when he died, he had a lot of needs.
Yes. And he had some devoted supporters, and he had the admiration of some very interesting poets in other countries. For example, Swinburne admired him tremendously. And, of course...
Around the world. Here's another way to answer the question. Whitman offers us hope of an American art and an American culture that's in addition to celebrity culture. It's something else besides what the corporations sell.
It makes him
very important.
I want us all to listen to the great Studs Terkel on the matter of Whitman in the here and now.
I wish there were more Whitman... And also not just reading him, but talking about him. This matter of the trades and the work and the jobs they do. The non-celebrated. See, he celebrates the non-celebrated. Our appreciation of life itself is what he wants to. Now, here, this place, this moment. You know, you can talk of the hereafter all you want, but this moment now. What you do, how you act, whom you hurt or help or don't hurt or don't help, yourself. He's always pertinent and relevant, by today more so than ever. This is embracing the world instead of bring 'em on. We have a young Neanderthal. We speak of the neocons and neolibs. They're neo-Neanderthals at work. They are, you know. You realize we can blow up the world and they can blow us up, and our ancestors will be our ancestors, our children's children's children, will be like our fathers' 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 fathers were. They'll be in caves. No more civilization as we know it. We can bomb the shit out of the world and destroy it, but then we can be destroyed in the process too. And so all of us and our quote-unquote enemies who are everywhere, enemies of people who are not us. And it's precisely the opposite of Whitman. Those us, those others are us, is Whitman is saying. And so imagine then a nightmare that is anti-Whitman if the world blows up. Our children's children's children will come out of caves with bull-eyed on back and club in hand and they'll see this darkness, and they'll be scared. And they'll be Neanderthals, and they'll say, there's a tribal memory. And that tribal memory will emerge certain words, and they'll say, Shakespeare, who dat? You know, ode on a Grecian urn. What that? Leaves of grass. Where is it? Ooh. It could be that. In other words, it could be anti-Whitman. Whitman is the opposite of all that. He's saying it's grand, the life, the grandness of everyday life, breathing, of living, of doing, the grandness of the ordinary things, and of the work, and a pride in it, and all that is there.
Thank you, Studs Terkel. Thank you, Stanley Kunitz, John Hollander, Robert Pinsky, Rosanna Warren. Visit our blog at radioopensource.org, where you can talk about Walt Whitman and help us work on shows yet to come. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, training practitioners and students for leadership in human rights. Our show was produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, Robin Amer, and Vanessa Bertozzi. Mike Wilkins was our engineer. Thanks also to Sidney Lewis, Jonathan Menhivar, Brian Morris, and Garrett Marino. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.